This is JS Party, your weekly celebration of JavaScript and the web. Are you missing out on the Changelog newsletter? Every Monday, I curate, contextualize, package up, and email you the developer news worth your attention. It's a totally free way to keep up with the fast pace of the software world the easy way. Sign up today at changelog.com/news. Big thanks to our partners, Fastly.com, Fly.io, and TypeSense.org. Okay, hey, it's party time, y'all.
So excited to be back with you all this week. We have a very special guest with us today. His name is Mark Erickson. Hello. Welcome, Mark.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Yeah. And it's just Mark and I today. And, you know, I think if we had any like other person here, we wouldn't even have enough time to maybe even finish the intro, because I mean, I know Mark, my brother Mark is a verbose man. In fact, we're going to be talking about a blog post he wrote today. That's why we're here. I'm going to admit, like, I haven't even finished the blog post. There's like three paragraphs that I haven't read yet. So my verbose friend, Mark, welcome. So excited to have you on the show. So we're going to be talking today about some of the challenges that Mark has been facing as a maintainer modernizing his packages, his Node packages to use ESM. And so Mark, I can give you this glowing introduction, which is like, you're like the internet teacher. You are the, world's most patient and verbose human being. You know a lot about JavaScript. You've done a really great job of being a steward for some of the like most widely adopted and maintained packages in our community. All the things. But why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, so my standard introduction blurb. My day job is working for a company called Replay.io, where we're building a true time-traveling debugger for JavaScript applications. I've been there for about a year and a half. I am loving working on this project. It is an incredibly useful tool. We've got a fantastic team. And as good as it is right now, and as much as it can make debugging easier right now, a year and a half from now, we're going to have some fantastic new features that we just haven't even had time to build yet. But like, I'm really excited about where things are going from here. Other than that, as you said, I answer questions any place there's a text box on the internet. I collect useful and interesting links. I write extremely long blog posts, and I maintain the Redux libraries. But most people know me as that guy with the Simpsons avatar.
Yeah, most people do know you for that, right? Because that's like the like helpful avatar that pops up to answer random questions like on a Twitter thread or like, it's like the most pleasant well actually, it's like I welcome your well actuallys. But yeah, no, Mark, thank you so much for joining us. So again, we're here to talk about modules and the process of, kind of moving this massive ecosystem of ours into the world of ESM. And, for those of you who might be wondering, like, why is this like a thing? You know, ESM became, a standard many years ago. It was actually technically part of the 2015 spec, although people have been working on modules for like beyond a decade before that officially became part of the spec. And so, so why is this a thing? Well, we're going to go through a little bit of history first before we kind of get into the crux of what Mark's famous blog post is all about. But the front end community kind of hijacked the Node ecosystem, right? Because we were using Bower and CDNs, and we were not in the Node space. And then React came along and was like, oh, you're going to need a compiler and you're going to need a Node runtime to like run and build your app. And so React kind of came onto the scene as a front end package in the Node ecosystem. And then like the rest was history, right? So can you kind of walk us through that evolution a little bit, Mark?
Sure. I love history lessons. Like I am generally a big fan of trying to understand when and why were tools created or why were certain technical decisions made, like in the context of that time and place. I think it's a lot easier to understand why things are the way they are now if you understand the decisions that were made, how we got here that way. So the first issue is that JavaScript as a language never had a built-in way to define packages or reusable modules in the same way that other languages like Java or Python did. So, you know, Java from the beginning, you declared packages with a package keyword, you organized your files and folders based on a certain structure, and the compiler and all the tools then automatically understood, you know, here's how you are defining your code. Yet there's an import statement, and then all the tooling worked based on that. And JavaScript never had anything like that. And that's both because JavaScript was very hastily thrown together, the infamous 10-day development period at the beginning, mm-hmm. but also because the intended use case early on was just like a tiny little bit of JavaScript in like a click handler or a mouse over, or maybe you've got a script tag in your HTML page, but it's, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 lines, maybe. And so like the original intent was just very small bits of interactivity. And starting, you know, maybe 2004, 2006, you know, around the time that Ajax started becoming a thing, people began writing, you know, real serious applications mm-hmm. in JavaScript. And now we're talking thousands, tens of thousands of lines of code. And
millions now.
millions. And you need a way to actually organize that code and to provide encapsulation and isolation and how different files refer to each other. So one of the first attempts to do something with this was actually just reusing a sort of discovered JavaScript construct, the immediately invoked function expression, or IFE. And people figured out that if I write my code for a quote-unquote module inside an IFE, it provides the encapsulation, and you can pass some arguments in, and it can return something, and it sort of kind of approximates what a package module might kind of feel like in other languages. And from there, you kind of had a couple different community-invented specs that came out. On the browser side, some people invented something called AMD, or asynchronous module definition, and it was supposed to be browser-friendly. So you would first load a library like require.js that understood the structure of these AMD modules, and you would point it at your top-level module file, and it would download it and look at it, and it specifies that it depends on, you know, modules A and B, and so it goes and downloads those, and B depends on C, and so it downloads that. And it's this whole big waterfall of requests, and eventually it's downloaded all of them, and then, you know, unwinds and loads each file, and everything initializes. And that was meant to be browser-based, you know, with the idea of downloading each file separately. On the other hand, on the Node side, they invented the CommonJS module format, which was specifically designed to be synchronous and read everything off disk at import time. So every time you call the require function, it actually does a very defined search in the local file system to try to find a file that matches the path that you gave it, which in a lot of cases isn't even a complete path. It has implicit assumptions about, you know, looking for index.js or looking for package.json and trying to find the main field and those sorts of things. So you had two different community-defined specs, neither of which was like standardized, both meant for different use cases.
And I'll interrupt you right there, because I think like this for me is like the beginning of the rift, right? Which is interesting, like looking at it in retrospective now. You know, you have people using JavaScript now in two different places, right? Folks who are using it exclusively in the browser and folks that are also using it in the server, in a server context, right? And remember, like Node was kind of like a revolutionary thing back in the day. Like, I don't think even Brendan and I could have predicted that like one day JavaScript would be used on the server, you know, one day JavaScript would be used to write scripts like that are running in washing machines. Like, you know, it's like, what, you know? And so So yeah, actually Whirlpool has like a phenomenal JavaScript engineering team for what it's worth. But, you know, so JavaScripting in these different runtimes means, you know, people are solving for this problem that really should just be part of the language, should be just be a standard feature, right? But it isn't there, right? It's this huge gaping gap in the world's most popular programming language, for God's sake, right? And so here they are now independently solving this problem in the best way that they know how, right? Making the best decisions with like under the constraints and all that jazz, right? But they're solving the same problem in different ways, right? And I think it's interesting to hear you talk about this rift, because this rift, it's, you know, bringing it back together, right? Like bringing us all back together to do it one way in these different contexts is like the real like source of pain here, right? Because there's some really big decisions, and we'll get into that later in the show. But anyways, so back to you, Mark.
Yep. Some people attempted to kind of paper over some of that problem and invented another module format called UMD, Universal Module Definition, which is this horribly, utterly hacky and disgusting looking wrapper that does some careful checks. And it means that the same file can be used simultaneously as either an AMD module in the browser, a common JS module under Node, or a plain script tag that attaches variables to the global window.
UMDs were like the hot, I think I can say the word on this podcast. They were hot when they first came out. UMDs were like, oh my God, it was revolutionary. It was like game changing. I remember that like the whole like community being so excited about UMD, because it was like, oh, we found a way, right? Because at that point, there was already a need, right? There was already code that was being shared between browser and server contexts. And, you know, we didn't have React, right? But we did, you know, this predated tools like React, but there was already a need in the community for that alignment. So I remember that solved a really big, a big problem back in the day. Mm-hmm.
So where we ended up is that there were several years of investigation and research into what an official module spec might look like. And that was finalized, as you said, as part of the ES 2015 language spec. And we ended up with what are now known as ES modules. And the biggest issue here is that the ES spec defines the syntax for ES modules, you know, the import and export keywords and how those are supposed to behave, and how when you export a variable, it's a live binding. So if something else imports it and then the first module reassigns to it, it actually gets the new value. But there were some parts of the behavior that they didn't specify. And that's roughly speaking how the host runtime environment, in other words, either a browser or Node, should actually handle like loading the files off disk, and how they should handle interoping with other module formats. And so what ended up happening is that browsers mostly figured out how they were going to implement the loading, you know, the downloading and the parsing and the execution of ES modules. But Node had a much harder time figuring out what they were going to do, because they had to worry, like Node was already all in on CommonJS. Node was built around this concept of CommonJS. And so now the question is like things like, if we look at any random.js file and we found it and we're trying to load it, how do we know ahead of time if that is supposed to be CommonJS or ESM? Like we really can't know it until we've actually tried to parse it and execute it and then find out that, oops, we guessed wrong. Or what happens if you've got an ESM file that tries to call require or tries to import a file that's CommonJS or vice versa? Like, what are the semantics and how does that interrupt? And so the Node folks ended up spending years debating all this and trying to figure out how it was going to work. And it was a very painful and involved process. A lot of people spent a lot of time arguing about how this stuff should work. Eventually, Node made some technical decisions and implemented them and moved on. And so in theory, Node has pretty good support for both CommonJS and ESM right now. But where this has led to is we have an ecosystem of many different tools with different expectations around how different modules. Oh, the other complicating factor, and this is what you were saying a minute ago, people have been wanting to use ES module syntax even since before the spec was finalized. And so bundlers like, you know, Webpack and Vite and Parcel and ES Build have had support for parsing and loading multiple modules of different kinds in one code base for years. So they've kind of had to invent their own semantics for what happens when you go back and forth and what happens if a common JS file imports an ESM file and all this stuff. And that doesn't necessarily match how like Node decided that they were going to do things. And then you get TypeScript in the picture.
Oh my God. Yeah, you hold that train for just a second. We can't even get to the TypeScript discussion yet. Hold on. So just to kind of recap here, like this is like for me, like this interesting cluster of like, whoa, the maintainer community kind of eagerly giving developers, you know, what they want and need right before there's even a decision as to how these things need to resolve under the hood, you know. And then don't forget, it's not like the bundlers got together and had a standard for how they were going to make these decisions. Each bundler had their own like logic and algorithm tree that they use for module resolution. And meanwhile, you have the Node TSC, the Technical Steering Committee, you know, folks, many folks who've been on this show in the past, you know, who've, you know, spent just years kind of trying to hash this out. And they kind of finally landed on something that shipped stable, I think, was it Node 13? Or sorry, I think it was 13, 14, something like that.
At least 16, if not 18, somewhere. I mean, like
I think if 13 was experimental and then maybe, yeah, and then 16, yeah, I think 16 was maybe when it was stable. So, you know, finally kind of shipped, but like, the community's been used to this frictionless experience already through the thankful like hard work of the, you know, folks who've been doing all the bundling. And so now, you know, how do we shift this to kind of work out of the box and just be turnkey is the real question, right? Like, because we can't have these like magic polyfilling machines like everywhere. That's not scalable or sustainable. And we, you know, like Webpack should not be a prerequisite to use Node, you know, or whatever tool. And so this is kind of where we are now. And, you know, we've had that problem kind of growing. And alongside it, you've had the kind of rise of TypeScript, right? Kind of around the same time as kind of we started to kind of figure out how we wanted to handle this and how to handle ESM in Node. And then we have like the hockey stick rise of TypeScript, which adds another layer of complexity into the already complex matrix. So yeah.
Yeah, and so there's multiple additional factors from there. I actually put out a tweet back in April when I was neck deep in the middle of all this stuff where I listed, like, here are things I have to keep in mind when I publish a library in 2023. And quoting myself, build artifact formats, ESM, CommonJS, UMD, matrixed with dev versus prod versus various Node-env flags. Am I pre-bundling my JavaScript library when I publish it, or am I publishing individual JS files per source? How do you define package.exports? What about Webpack 4? What about TypeScript's module resolution option? What about different user environments? What about different bundlers? Node in ESM versus CJS mode? Do I need to pre-bundle my TypeScript type defs? What about Edge runtimes? What about React having the new like use client keyword or needing to deal with server components differently? Oh, and what about all the libraries that I depend on? It's a mess.
With something like only wear green socks part of that list too, because it just sounds like such a kooky list that you probably should have like a special piece of clothing on you, like when you're publishing
pretty
a
much,
new package.
Pretty much, know? Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, so enter TypeScript. So let's talk about how TypeScript complicates this landscape, Mark, before we kind of dig into some of the specific pain points that were outlined in your epic blog post.
Well, so there's a couple more things that even tie in along with the TypeScript aspect. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we said earlier that the front-end ecosystem kind of jumped on the Node train, and that includes publishing packages to NPM. And publishing a package to NPM wasn't that bad in the beginning if you make the assumption that everyone who uses this is also just running it under Node.
That's a fair assumption for what it's worth. Like, you know, reasonable assumption.
But now that we're, you know, starting to worry about, and by now I'm you know, referring backwards to like, you know, 2011, 2012, you start worrying about, I need to publish this code so that it can run in a browser. Well, okay, we're going to publish this code to NPM in common JS format, because that's what most tools are going to understand. But we also need to make sure that we backwards compile our JavaScript syntax, because everyone has to worry about running their code in IE11, and IE11 only understands ES5 syntax. So even at that point, like if you wanted to write and author your library code using upcoming JavaScript syntax, like, you know, what eventually became ES2015, you had to backwards transpile your own code at build time to ES5 and common JS so that it was the lowest common denominator, and, you know, build tools could load the modules and the syntax itself would execute in IE11. And that's basically where we've been at for 7+ years. Like, even now, most libraries are compiling to Common JS and compiling the syntax to ES5 so that it works everywhere. And it's just within the last couple of years where we've really started seeing more libraries not just including an ES module file in their published package, but trying to make it the primary file and actually saying, okay, we're going to ship a more modern syntax, whether it's ES2017 or just literally like, here's the syntax I wrote minus the TypeScript types. And that's where the other thing comes in, is that with everyone using TypeScript to write, well, many people using TypeScript to write their code, that's another layer of a build step, because TypeScript code won't run in any runtime environment. So at a bare minimum, even if you're not going to convert the syntax, you have to at least strip out the TypeScript types when you publish it.
Yeah, that sounds like a good time. Sounds like there needs to be a service, you know, publish as a service. Like, you know, like I wrote this in whatever language, whatever runtime, just here, you make it work for, you know, make it work for everyone else. Like that, this should just be like, yeah, there should, like, you know, like a Jetsons machine, you know, like, you know, yeah. You put whatever code in, then it spits out like this huge matrix of formats that you can distribute. It's crazy. Like a podcast distribution or something, right? Like wherever you get your podcasts, right? Like wherever you run your code, here, take this. It should work, you know? But anyways, okay. So like getting into this, this TypeScript craziness, can you kind of like, you know, as most people are not maintainers, right? So most people are kind of on the consumption side. I know for a fact that like people on the consumption side have experienced a lot of friction around this, especially in the early days when Node was kind of experimenting with ESM. There's just a lot of import errors and like, oh, why, you know, like there's super, I could, back in the day, I would almost have that error memorized, you know, like the, like when you try to use import in a Node context, like it's like there's some reference error. I can't.
Error module not found, something, something.
Right. That's like, yeah, Google that. Like there's like so many hits for that. Right. But can you kind of just, can you share some insights into like, what are some of the common pain points that you see people hitting, like because of these issues, right? Before we flip over to kind of the maintainer hell that you are in, you know, how are everyday people, kind of everyday developers, feeling this pain point?
So developers certainly run into this stuff downstream from the libraries. And I even ran into this, and we might talk about it in a minute, when I was attempting to make my first updates to Redux Toolkit to modernize some of its packaging. The Redux Toolkit depends on the Redux Thunk library, which I maintain, and the Emmer library, which I do not. And my attempts to modernize the package worked somewhat, but then like Jest, which is yet another tool that does its own module parsing, doesn't have great ESM support. And it was getting confused because it was trying to load both those packages in an ESM context. And instead of getting, like, they both mix default exports and named exports. And instead of getting the actual values that I wanted, I was getting back an object with a key of default inside of it, which is not the thing that the code expected. So there's that. There's the error module not found thing that you were talking about. A lot of app developers have seen problems where some library authors like Sindre Sorhus, you know, prolific author of Node-related libraries, have decided that they're just going to go ESM only for everything. And he published major versions of all his packages. He even put up a guest saying, here's my reasons why everything I do is ESM only from here on out. And I can absolutely understand and respect the technical and personal reasons behind that decision. But it's also meant that in a lot of cases, people upgraded dependencies, either intentionally or unintentionally. And all of a sudden, like the latest version of Chalk or NodeFetch or something like that broke because the rest of their toolchain isn't properly configured to load these libraries the way that the author is now publishing them. And so a lot of people have had to revert back to the previous major version of these libraries just so it's not ESM only.
Yeah, great summary. I mean, you know, the Node ecosystem is like this like Legoland, right? Where, I mean, that's the beauty of it. And also the one of the pain points, I think, especially for smaller teams or people, you know, newer developers, you know, you having to kind of like maintain the matrix of interoperable packages and their peer dependencies and whatnot, as well as kind of what runtime version you have, right? Like what version of Node are you even running? And does this version of Node support top level awaits, for example, right? And so, yeah, I mean, Sonorous, I just said Sonorous. I always mispronounce their
Sindre
name.
Sindre Sorhus, I think.
Dino Man, okay. His whole thing with, oh, I'm only going to publish ESM, you know, which I respect their decision to do that. But the implication of that is that, you know, you might not be running the right version of Node. Your customers might not be running the latest version of a browser that would support said language syntax. And so, you know, there's some serious ripple effects. And so then are you kind of transpiling your dependencies? You know, how do you even manage that process easily, as a team? And so, you know, there's pretty big downsides, but you know, the flip side of this is that, like, unfortunately, our Node dependencies have kind of been stuck in 2014, right? Because no one is publishing quote unquote modern JavaScript as their final output, right? And so you have like bytes and bytes of JavaScript that could be removed from the web, and you know, we could be better optimizing all sorts of things. And there's an initiative that I tried to start like many years ago and just kind of like got really busy, but kind of trying to kind of say, hey, can we have a standard around how we publish our dependencies, right? Because we should be able to publish modern JavaScript and not hold the web back, right? So that's like, that's a whole thing to like, right now, like the web is very much held back by all of the third-party JavaScript that's in 2014 code, right? So minus Dino Man, right? So yeah, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and like I said earlier, like the fact that packages have generally had to publish the lowest common denominator in terms of module formats and syntax has definitely added to, you know, the weight of web pages. And so being able to ship modern, like, you know, for example, like optional chaining is great. I love optional chaining syntax. Have you ever seen what it gets transpiled to? Like that little question dot ends up as like 80 or 100 characters of like something, something, bang, double equals, void, zero, blah, 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 blah. And like, if we can just ship modern JavaScript, that's way fewer bytes that have to go out to the browser.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a win-win for everyone. It's a win-win for users. It's a win-win for developers. It's a win-win for the earth, because that's literally like less resources and like less bytes across the wire, less internet trash, all kinds of things. To kind of get back to the TypeScript problem here and some of the issues that you described as consumer pain points, I think, you know, you're kind of when you publish this blog post, like you're airing out, I think, the next piece of dirty laundry to kind of go live in the JavaScript community, which is these pain points, right? So I know you published this blog post on August 8th. It's had like a lot of circulation, and actually one of our Changelog plus listeners, Nick, if you're listening, actually requested this episode, and they were like, hey, you know, would love to have it like here, like a discussion on this topic. And I was like, well, why don't we just invite Mark back onto the show? I love my Mark, main man Mark, you know? And so, you know, you kind of going viral with this post means, you know, that yeah, people are feeling this pain as well as you, right? So can you kind of share some thoughts on that?
Yeah. So I guess first off, like when I write my blog posts, yes, I'm writing them with the idea that someone's going to read them. But usually I have some idea, like, this is a topic that people actually be interested in or not. Like, you know, the one about how React renders has been by far my most widely read post, because that's a thing that people care about and often don't really understand. But this one, like, trust me, I was not reading this with an expectation that it was going to get lots of views. It was just, I've gone through the, you know, all these pain points. This is mostly me attempting to document them just as an FYI for folks. And, you know, it hasn't necessarily gotten like tons of views, but it actually has gotten a surprisingly large amount of people saying, this is a good article, thank you for writing it, or, you know, I'm a library maintainer and yeah, I'm experiencing all these pain points. So it definitely has struck a bit of a nerve.
Yeah. I mean, having to kind of like publish for this crazy matrix of considerations, right, means that like you have to sometimes you kind of question yourself. You're like, well, is this it can't really be this bad. Like, maybe it's just me. Right. And I think by you kind of like airing your grievances and saying like, these are all the things that I had to do, and these are the issues that I still have, and these are the problems that I hit for this big widely adopted package, it kind of like really lets people kind of come out of the woodworks too, to say, you know, oh great, it's not just me, you know. So
it's been so okay, like, you have to understand that I have this very, I don't know, Jekyll and Hyde view of myself. Like, there's plenty of times when I come into a conversation and like, I'm the Redux maintainer, I know what I'm doing, you should totally listen to what I have to say. But there's lots of other times where I genuinely feel like I don't know much about this topic. And that may or may not be an accurate view of myself, but that's the feeling that I have. And there have been a couple who like read this post and legitimately told me, like, almost verbatim, it's like, wow, if Mark Erickson doesn't know what he's doing, how, like, how can anyone else know this? Which is hilarious, because I barely know what I'm doing here.
This is a Changelog news break. You can add Meta's Code Llama to the ever-expanding list of code-generating LLMs. Based on Llama 2, Code Llama comes in three sizes: 7 billion parameters, 13 billion, and 34 billion. And it comes in three different varieties: a general model, one tuned for NLP instructions, and one fine-tuned for Python. How does it stack up? Well, Meta claims it outperforms other publicly available LLMs, and it shares the same open-ish license as Llama itself, which is free for research and commercial use, unless you compete with Meta. You just heard one of our five top stories from Monday's Changelog News. Subscribe to the podcast to get all of the week's top stories and pop your email address in at changelog.com/news to also receive our free companion email with even more developer news worth your attention. Once again, that's changelog.com/news.
Let's get into kind of some of the specifics here. So we're going to flip on to talking about what are these serious pain points that Mark has experienced along with other developers. And, you know, where should we start? Should we start with the...
We'll go through the post sort of in order. And like, I can just sort of recap things off my own head.
Sounds great.
At the start of this year, I was the primary maintainer for five different Redux-related packages: the original Redux Core, React Redux, Reselect, Redux Thunk, and Redux Toolkit. And all those have been around for years. We'd even published major versions of like React Redux in the last couple of years, but most of them had publishing and build setups that went back many, many years. And on top of that, Redux Toolkit, we published version 1.0 in late 2019. We're up to version 1.9. And I'd made a few updates to the publishing setup, switching to something ES Build for that project a couple years ago. But most of them, we were just building with Rollup and Babel and shipping a whole big mixture of CommonJS, ESM, and UMD files. And none of those projects specified the relatively new package.exports field to define how different build and runtime tools should determine which module file they're supposed to load. And we'd gotten some reports from people saying, like, if I try to import Redux Toolkit in a full ESM node environment, then it errors, module not found error. Some people have said that we can't import the right things with certain TypeScript settings. And then along with that, the other points I mentioned where we were still compiling all the code to ES5 to support IE11, and we generally wanted to ship modern JavaScript and better support full ES module compatibility, whatever the heck that actually means. And I'd been squirreling away hundreds of bookmarks about this topic for years, knowing it was a thing that was eventually going to happen and scared me. And so I finally started to look at it at the start of this year. And I did a bunch of research, and I thought I knew what I was doing, and I was very wrong. And I tried to update Redux Toolkit to add package exports, and I tried putting the type module field into our package.json, thinking that was a thing that I needed to do. And like I said, stuff broke. In this case, primarily just not being able to load dependencies properly.
And you put type module in your package.json, right? Just because there's like maybe a few other places you could have potentially even done something similar to that, right? There's like tsconfig, there's package.json, right?
I was under the impression that putting the field type module in your project's package.json was a requirement for quote unquote ES module compatibility. I didn't even fully 100% understand what that meant, but I thought that it was a thing that I had to do. And as I found out later, the core issue there is that, like I said, Node has to figure out for any given file, is this CommonJS or ESM? And originally, everyone's just shipping files with a .js extension and importing them, requiring them, whatever. So if both your CommonJS and your ESM files have a .js extension, how can it know without parsing them? And so what the Node folks decided was there's two different ways you can do it. One is you can actually use different file extensions. If it's .mjs, it's an ESM file. If it's .cjs, it's a CommonJS file. But where does that leave any .js files? And so what they decided was that if you put a type module field in your package.json, that is telling Node that anytime you see a plain .js extension, assume it is a module. Or you can use, I think, type CommonJS to say assume that it's a CommonJS file. And so I didn't really understand the implications.
What if we don't have anything there? If you don't have anything there, it's just default, right, to CommonJS.
Yeah, still defaulting to assuming CommonJS for all .js extensions.
Yeah, which makes sense for like backwards compatibility, right? To think about all the like thousands and thousands of Node projects that are CommonJS and, they want to be able to still bump their Node versions, right? So of course they're going to try to do this in a way that's not going to break everybody's app automatically. That would be like the death of Node, you can't upgrade. And just to be clear, like the MJS, like where did I like stopped following that discussion, because it just like, I was like, I can't think about this right now. It's gone back and forth. Where have we landed on MJS as a thing now, right? Because I haven't really seen wide scale use of that. But I'm wondering if you have, or if you're more familiar.
I don't know much more than, I honestly don't know much more of the discussion other than realizing that A, it was a thing that I could actually do. B, it was actually going to be simpler and easier to name my own output files with a .mjs extension than it would be to put a type module in the package file. And frankly, I still think that .mjs and .cjs look stupid, but type module caused enough complications for me that I decided that, okay, fine, changing the file extension of the output files that I build seems to be less trouble overall than having type module in the package.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, where does TypeScript fit into this too, where, is it MTS, and which by the way sounds like a Northeastern Metro system or something like that, MTS,
that's the same kind of problem. So
CTS sounds like a network television, channel.
TypeScript tries to follow, TypeScript now has several different rule sets for how it determines both where are your JavaScript files and where are your type definition files in a project. And so that's now controlled by a TypeScript config option called module resolution. The original setting is Node, or now renamed to Node 10, which is kind of like the old school option. There's a new Node 16 option, which tries to match Node's current behavior. And then there's also a new bundler option that's kind of like, do whatever Webpack and other similar tools do. And that also implies, like, one of the things that Andrew Branch from the TypeScript team pointed out is that you can have mismatches between your runtime code and your TypeScript types. Like, because of how the module formats work, if you only publish one set of types, and for example, by default, it has a .d.ts extension, TypeScript's going to say, oh, that's types that are sort of meant for a common JS file, right? But the runtime behavior in the exports of an ESM file could be different. That having output the types representing common JS might not be accurate for what actually happens at runtime. So the quote unquote correct answer here, per Andrew Branch, is that you really need to publish two copies of your TypeScript types for your library. One generated with TypeScript having common JS settings, and one generated with TypeScript having ES module settings. And those two should have a file extension that matches your JS file's extension. So if you're publishing a .mjs JS file, you should also publish a .d.mts type definitions file.
Wow. Yeah, no, this sounds like living hell to me. I don't know about you all listeners, but yeah, this does not sound fun. And is there like a GitHub comment or a blog post or something that we can cite to include in our show notes for that recommendation that Andrew had?
So actually, if you look at the bottom of my blog post, I tried to link a few different things. One of those items, Andrew Branch is working on a very large new set of documentation for the TypeScript docs that will talk about here's how TypeScript understands modules and the state of the world. And the current work in progress for that is in a gist, and it's pretty long. Like it's several thousand words at least.
Well, I guess my question is, why does it have to be any different than how JavaScript understands it, right? Like in the sense that, does there need to be a distinction other than just how we handle types? And like that should also just be very straightforward for the most part. Like I'm just trying to understand like why the need to kind of have a whole complex like second system here.
I'm going to do a bad job explaining it, but the one line summary is that it's because TypeScript is a types only overlay on top of whatever happens at runtime. In fact, here's even one of the goofier things that I still haven't fully wrapped my head around. So one of the other aspects of using ESM, especially under Node, is I believe in some cases you really need to actually specify .js as part of an import statement. So, you know, import curly braces, whatever, right, from .slash some other file .js, close quotes. And I'm still not even 100% sure when that's necessary. But, okay, what happens if I am authoring a file in TypeScript and all my TypeScript files have a .ts extension? Your import, but like, that's just at compile time. At runtime, all your files have a .js extension, so you have to write import .slash something .js in a TS file in some cases. And I still don't even know when that's necessary, but that scares me.
Well, you could compile away that, right? Like you could have like a pre-build step that like replaces that or whatever the hell else.
Well, that's the problem. Like the TypeScript folks are trying to stand firm on like, yeah, we had a couple features way in the past that required runtime changes, but from here on out, we do types level stuff. Okay, we don't rewrite your source code. So there's multiple issues where people have begged, let us write .ts in our imports and then just like rewrite that to .js for us at output time. And the TypeScript folks are like, nope, that's runtime changes. Not going to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it just makes like grepping your code that much like one more thing you have to think about when you're just trying to grep for like all matches of a file name or whatever, right? Or a file path. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, we're living this lovely like module hell. So that is 2023. But anyway, so moving on your blog post. So where did we leave off?
Yeah, so my first attempt at trying to modernize Redux Toolkit's package didn't work. And I concluded that I'm going to have to spend a whole bunch of time setting up example projects using a half dozen build tools and environments and combinations so that I can verify that any future attempts to update the package actually work right in each of those environments. So I wrote a little tiny Redux Toolkit sample app and a playwright test, and then I built it with Create React App 4, which uses Webpack 4, Create React App 5, which uses Webpack 5, which supports the export keyword, Vite and Next, and then a couple of different like Node in CJS mode and Node in ESM mode folders. And that at least helped. The other really big thing I found was that same Andrew Branch guy has written a tool called Are the Types Wrong? And you give it a package name and it will download the package and say, here's how TypeScript is going to interpret the way you've defined everything. And it actually points out a number of common mistakes. Like, do you have a mismatch between your JS files and your TS types? Or whoops, something you listed just like, we can't even find that at all. And so using that as both a local command line tool for checking things and a CI tool for verifying that, you know, this PR doesn't break anything has been incredibly valuable. And in fact, I was using that even trying to work on stuff last night.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I think that's, you've kind of made yourself like your own little pre-package pub, like dressing room, you know, kind of space where you're just like, all right, now let me fake publish, mm-hmm. right, with Yalk or something. And
exactly that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I'm going to make sure that everything still works as expected. And I think for me, like, I'm really appreciate, and I hope the community does as well, of course, the diligence that you're going through to make sure that there's no edge cases for people, depending on what kind of combo they have, like runtime, bundler, et cetera. But really, like, this is a moving target. Like, let's be real, right?
Very much so, yeah.
And so there's no, it's not a magic bullet. And so it's just like, you're like one publish away in any given thing, any given thing changes and like you're back to square one potentially. And so,
and there's even another example of that popped up literally like last night or this morning. So the React team has been working on React server components for the last couple of years. Uh-huh. And I think it's a genuinely interesting and, you know, very useful technology. But there's been issues both around kind of like the marketing rollout as well as the way that, you know, like the React team in Vercel have been implementing the first real usable version of it. And there's documentation about how to use it inside of Next as an application developer, but there's no real documentation about how libraries are supposed to interact with a React server components environment. And so this has popped up in a few different ways. So Next 13.4 came out back in May, and they flipped their defaults so that if you just keep hitting enter when you create a new project from the command line, it defaults to a server components setup. And the documentation says you're supposed, like, shows using server components by default. And so people are following the defaults and trying to use server components without really thinking about the pros and cons. And a lot of people still want to use Redux. And so they're trying to add Redux and thinking they can just, you know, throw the React Redux provider in one of their server components. But it turns out server components have a lot of technical restrictions. You can't call create context from within a server component import. You can't call or use any of the React hooks in a server component. And so people were trying to do what they thought was the obvious thing of, I know how to set up Redux, I'm just going to add it to this parent component, and it would break. And then they would file issues against either the React Redux or Redux Toolkit repos and say, why doesn't this work right? And then we had to spend hours, you know, looking into it before we asked, oh, are you using Next and server components? And they would say yes, and then we'd figure, oh, those don't actually work together, at least not the way you think they do. Like you can render it inside what's now called a client component, but you have to have that separation from the server component part of the page.
That doesn't even feel like a Mark problem, though. That this feels like, you know, maybe the rollout of this feature on the React side could have come with some more training wheels and guidelines and all the above, you know?
Yeah. And that's actually the exact point I've both stated in the blog post and tried to pass on as hopefully helpful feedback to the React team. But it's been an effect on us as the Redux maintainers.
No pun intended.
And Lens as in the other maintainers of Apollo and folks on React Query and so on. And so there, in particular, there was one discussion thread where one of the next canary builds, you know, one of their just daily type of builds, briefly broke Apollo client because it was starting to check for, are you importing any client-side code at all? And if so, let's throw an error. And they undid that change, but that whole discussion thread led to a pretty long debate between me and Lens, Redux maintainers, and Apollo for Lens, and Sebastian Markbaga and a couple of the Vercel folks. And there was a whole back and forth where, you know, Seb was saying, you know, like, well, you can add another exports condition to your package and create a whole nother build artifact just for use in React server components that makes sure it doesn't use any client code whatsoever, so it's safe. And Lens and I were pointing out that, wait, like, that's a whole lot more work for us. It's yet another build artifact we have to figure out how to generate. In the case of like Apollo, they're not even using package exports. They can't do that until the next major versions. And it felt very, very frustrating to be told, you have to do more work to satisfy this one extra runtime environment on top of all the work I'd already, you know, put in over the last several months. So there was even yet another development in that just like last night. Sebastian had suggested that, like, okay, you can sort of fool our static analyzer if instead of doing named imports of hooks like use state, you do a import star as React, and then like our static analyzer won't even notice that. And so you can sort like we sort of kind of nudge, nudge, wink, wink, suggest that you do that for now. And someone apparently reported to Apollo last night that, you know, Apollo has been using this for a little while now. And that apparently broke in the latest version of Next. And I don't know if it's a bug on their side or what, but it's just like emphasis on the moving target and so many things we have to worry about.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's just obvious at this point, like, right. And this is maybe, I know we have a couple more things to get through on the blog post, but like, there's a big need here for some standards and for everyone to kind of be working and publishing against like the same specs, right? That mm-hmm. way, as long as everyone's following the specs and everyone's following the rules, then there's confidence in that handshakes should just work. Because I mean, really, this should just work, right? Like, we're really I expect a lot of this churn to leak out into the community. Like, it already is, but it you know, in the unless we fix it, it's only going to get worse, you know?
And like, I've been begging for years for someone who actually knows what they're doing, aka not me, to publish like the authoritative comprehensive guide on the right way to publish a package and all the output options and all the build tool configuration settings and all the file formats. Like, tell me exactly what buttons to hit so that I can follow it, or even better, like, give me tools that will do that.
Well, I can tell you that right now, like, that's not going to, I mean, I can't say that with like 100% confidence, but I say this with a high degree of confidence, like that's not going to come like out of NPM anytime soon, just given where it's just like they have a skeleton team running the registry right now. What I'm confused about is like, if Microsoft wasn't interested in actually investing in this ecosystem, like why
did they purchase these companies?
Any number of other big tech companies were also interested in purchasing at the time, and so like, you know, really it should have just been in hands that were where the registry and the project, this important part of the ecosystem, would actually get the TLC and the love that it deserves. You know, that was like the only silver lining for me when that acquisition happened, was like, okay, well, at least there's a big company here to take care of this now. And, you know, problems have only been really getting worse. And so it's not going to come out of NPM. And so the question is, like, I think this has to be community driven, you know, as always. So,
I mean, to name a specific name, Jason Miller, who works at Google, has done a lot of fantastic work over the last few years trying to encourage folks to ship modern JavaScript. And he's written some good articles that are helpful starting points. I have felt like he would be the right person to write that kind of a definitive module publishing guide, but he's obviously very busy with, you know, whatever stuff it is he's actually working on.
Yeah, he's now at Shopify, has been for at least a year yeah. or two, I think. But yes.
Shows you how much attention I've been paying. I'm sorry.
And that's okay. That's fine. It's all good. And just in case anyone was curious, Jason Miller is creator of Preact as well. An awesome person who's been on the show a couple times at least. So yeah, so I think getting back into, we've been talking for like almost an hour and we're not even through all the things, but I'll let you pick up wherever you want to pick up, Mark.
I mean, that's the major summary. I mean, if you look at my blog post, it amounts to, I took a first stab at things. They didn't work out. I spent a couple months trying to build example CI setups to double check myself and tell me when things were breaking. I made a second round of attempts that mostly worked, except for, are the types wrong, telling me you've still got that like JS versus TS file extension mismatch in some cases. And so right now we've got Redux Toolkit 2.0 beta and Redux Core 5.0 beta published. We've got alphas for Reselect and Redux Thunk. And actually, today's Thursday. Tuesday night, I finally managed to push through the first alpha for React Redux version 9 that has the same packaging changes. And like, I determined months ago that we're going to have to ship major versions of all of our libraries simultaneously, which, oh boy, self-imposed responsibilities.
Yeah.
But we've at least got alphas or betas of all five packages with the same general packaging contents applied to each of them. Last night, I was working on trying to resolve the last outstanding are the types wrong warnings by actually attempting to generate those duplicated TypeScript type definition files. And are the types wrong thought it looked good locally. And then I pushed the PR and literally everything broke.
What was the gap there, and are you going to submit a patch in the tool to try to
I literally just need to look at it again and figure out what's going on. Like all one of our CI checks is that we double check our types against like 8 versions of TypeScript simultaneously just to see if, you know, we broke anything, and all those failed. And I glanced at the output very briefly, and I don't remember what the actual problem was. I'm not sure if it was having trouble finding the types or if something in the modified type definition files that I was bundling was wrong, because that was actually a change. Like Redux Toolkit had shipped with just running TSC and generating 1.d.ts file per TypeScript source file. And what I changed last night was actually using this TSUP tool to pre-bundle the TypeScript types so that it would be easier to ship the duplicate copies. And something about that broke. And I'm not sure if it is something about the bundling of the types step done by the tool or whether it's something about the way that I'm pointing to the files. But I literally, that was my cue to call it quits for the night. So I will go back and investigate further, and, you know, hopefully I'll actually figure out what's going on and then be able to apply that to the other libraries too.
And write another blog post, right?
Well, update this one.
Update this one. Okay, got it. We'll have to look at the version history. Now you're going to have to start publishing a version history for this post. But for those listening, like if this sounds dense and complicated and confusing, it because it is. And I would highly recommend for all of you to read Mark's post. I'm going to finish reading it. And I learned a lot. And also just I think you did a really good job of like putting really good references out to different resources in there as well, including one that I really enjoyed, which was the history. It's a gist on modules, history and future. So it's like a full timeline of like all the things with links for like when we started working on ESM and just how that evolution kind of has gone from early, you know, from like 2008, 2009, all the way to the kind of present day. And so just lots of great resources, highly recommend checking it out. And so Mark, like, what are some parting thoughts? You know, obviously you had some like lessons learned that you shared. Do you want to maybe kind of share that on air a little bit?
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, we've got the betas and the alphas out right now. The current package definitions for each of those, I think, is close to being correct for us. It's certainly possible that other libraries with, you know, different needs for how they need to package and ship things would need somewhat different setups. But I think I've seen to have found a combination that is reasonably correct for us, minus the type mismatch issue. It is really hard to keep up with the nuances of all the different tools, and I wish there were a resource that listed how each bundler and each runtime environment handle things in some kind of a way. There's a couple resources I've found, but not quite the thing that I have in mind. Similarly, I have found a couple guides to how to try to publish a package, and they are useful. Again, I think I have a picture in my head for what I sort of imagine the ideal resource to look like, and no one has written that yet, and no, I'm not going to because I don't have time. Having better tooling would drastically help.
What about standards? No mention of standards. Like,
standards would be exceptionally helpful too.
Yeah.
Like having standards, having guides, having tools that, you know, correctly output, you know, the right combinations would be extremely helpful. As would having something like some kind of a, you know, a SAS where you can say like, here's my library, here's the code for an example app that uses my library. Please just automatically generate projects for like 10 different frameworks and build tools and build them all and tell me which ones succeed and break. Because that's basically what I had to build for myself, roughly. And then, you know, server components are a great idea. I think they are going to be a very valuable part of the React ecosystem, but the technical rollout has been rocky and confusing. And then, yeah, like we're going to be stuck with somewhere in between CJS and ESM for a number of years. I even saw a pair of blog posts just recently where the Dino folks were arguing that CJS is dead and holding us back. And the Bun maintainer said, actually, CJS is, number one, still widely used, two, still useful, three, even loads faster in a lot of cases.
Yeah, it's also like, let's not just, I mean, we have to understand the sheer scale of the internet and the sheer scale of Node and how many things are written in Node that will never, ever get updated even, you know, like, this is just like the internet, right? Like, when you're developing web standards, the goal is like, don't break the web. Like when you that's like the number one principle for new proposals. So yeah, I think this decision is here to stay forever. So I don't think this is ever going to be, like, I think hopefully there'll be less and less people writing CJS is my guess over time. But ultimately, like, it's never going to ever go away, right? Like, right. If you're a maintainer or you want to write a new bundler or whatever it is, you know, like, you're going to have to, unless you're, you know, you're only targeting greenfield new projects or projects that are strictly never going to use CJS or CJS dependencies, like, which is like, who, like, I mean, come on, let's be real, right? Like, even your dependencies might kind of hold you back there to some degree. So
COBOL and Fortran are still being used.
Exactly. Yeah. Great examples. So yeah, I mean, you know, this was a really great discussion and some of the pain points of shifting tides. Really, this is what this is. This is like it's a shift. It's a big, wide, horizontal shift, right? Because this isn't something that's a vertical. It affects everything kind of uniformly. It's a baseline shift. And so thank you so much for being such a great resource and a lighthouse for our community, Mark. We really appreciate you. And thank you for all the great resources and links. There'll be lots of links in our show notes, lots of links in Mark's blog post. So check them out. And so if folks want to kind of follow you and catch up with you, Mark, where can they find you on the interwebs?
Ace Markey on Twitter, blog.isquaredsoftware.com. Ace Markey on Reddit, Mark Erickson on GitHub.
Awesome. Well, thank you. And so with that said, have an amazing rest of, have an amazing rest of your week. I'm like, wait, hold on. People listen to this like Sunday night, Friday morning, Thursday, Monday, Tuesday. Whatever week you're in. Yes. Have a great rest of your day, whoever is listening. All right, everybody. Ciao, ciao.
This episode features a bonus 5 minutes for our Changelog plus people. Amel has been on fire with the bonuses lately. If our membership program is news to you, learn all about it at changelog.com/plus. There's a link in your show notes and chapter data.
Just paste it in there. What could go wrong?
Thanks once again to our partners, Fastly.com, Fly.io, and TypeSense.org. And to our beat freaking residents, Breakmaster Cylinder. Next up on the pod, Nick, Amel, Chris, and yours truly discuss the news, including Astro 3.0, and play a game of head lies. Is it a headline? Is it a head lie? You decide. Stay tuned right here. We'll drop that episode in your podcast app next week.